Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of the Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life podcast. My name is ontologically Marcus Freestone. And this week we have an episode based on another listener question. The question I was sent this week was, is depression becoming more widespread, and is 21st century modern living making us increasingly stressed and anxious? So let's take the first part of that question to begin with. Are rates of depression increasing? In researching this episode, I watched an excellent YouTube video from the Australian public lecture series Festival of Dangerous Ideas from 2014. One of the panelists was Gordon Parker, a professor of psychiatry and researcher into mental health. He made a distinction between normal, everyday depression and clinical depression, something I have also frequently done on the podcast, and it's something that bears a brief repetition because it may seem a semantic point, but it was said to me 20 years ago when I was first diagnosed with depression. Someone said to me, oh, well, I get depressed. Everyone gets depressed. What are you talking about? And there is a radical difference between the feeling of everyday sadness or being a bit pissed off about something or reactive depression and what's known as endogenous depression or clinical depression. So reactive depression is you lose your job, someone you love dies or something like that, something bad happens in your life, you'll feel down and depressed for a while and then you'll come out of it and you'll be fine. Clinical depression is where you have many symptoms, such as psychomotor retardation, where your brain and your body slows down, and you can put people in a brain scanner and say, yes, this person has clinical depression. Their brain is actually physically functioning differently, and their body is physically functioning differently. So it's a pity that this needs saying, but clinical depression is a real thing. It's completely different to everyday sadness and everyday stresses, and it is a biological clinical condition. And I've mentioned in previous podcasts, in fact, as this subject has come up, and I've done some interesting research this week. Next week, I'm going to do a whole episode following on from this one on the biology of depression and stress and anxiety. So we'll be going into that in a lot more detail in episode 21 next week. So Gordon Parker's professional assessment was that while it's true that reported rates and diagnosis of depression have skyrocketed in recent decades, this is largely due to the clinical criteria for diagnosing depression having been drastically lowered. And this chimes exactly with my own conclusions in recent years about the DSM increasingly including normal human behaviour under a clinical umbrella in a damaging and erroneous way. And the DSM, for those who don't know, is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's a book that's been published since the 1960s by the American Psychological Association, and it's now on its fifth imprint, which was published a couple of years ago. And the first volume was a pamphlet. This one is like War and Peace. And it's a list of all clinical, psychiatric, mental, psychological conditions. And the criteria for this, as I said, have been rapidly lowered over the years. And we've now got to the ridiculous state where in America you have seven-year-old kids on Ritalin or antidepressants. And I heard recently that in America there are even dogs who are on antidepressants. I'll just repeat that for those people who don't live in California. Dogs are on antidepressants. That is absurd, and also, of course, horribly cruel to the dogs, because you don't know what effect that's going to have on them. But I mean, that just goes to show the absurd levels that this has got to. And this overdiagnosis, of course, leads many people to say, oh, depression's not real, because there are all these cases of people being diagnosed with so-called clinical depression who clearly aren't clinically depressed. So then you get people who haven't looked into it sufficiently saying, oh, well, obviously it's all rubbish and there's no such thing as depression, but there is. And I firmly believe that much of this is down to pressure from the multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical industry, which is obviously one of the most powerful industries in the world. In America, bizarrely, they can advertise antidepressants on television. So more and more people, especially in these days of the interwebs and all that, more and more people are self-diagnosing and going to their doctor and demanding the pills they've seen in the glossy TV adverts. I think also that in a world of increasingly disenfranchised people with little purpose or meaning in their lives, having a string of medical conditions can sometimes become a way of defining themselves and building an identity. And I've certainly met people in the past who make the whole identity the fact that they have some chronic condition, whether real or imaginary. And I think that's a separate thing from hypochondria. It's also a great way of abdicating responsibility and making excuses for one's personal failures. It's not my fault I have condition X. And this, of course, is sometimes even used in criminal cases where people literally get away with murder because of some real or imagined psychiatric condition. And I know this is true because I've frequently been guilty of this gross existential cop-out myself. I've let my health problems limit my life and ambition far more than I should have, and I know that I'm not alone in this. There is also the problem that doctors cannot help you fix your normal life problems or your relationship or whatever is really bothering you, especially in an appointment that's limited to a few minutes. So, lacking the resources to offer useful long-term therapy, that's certainly the case in Britain, their only recourse is to reach for the prescription pad and give out antidepressants or Valium. And when I was 25, I made, I think, the fatal mistake of going to my GP because I was having a lot of trouble coping with life. And I was diagnosed with depression and put on antidepressants and sent to a psychiatrist. And whilst I'm not questioning the diagnosis, I very clearly, as we'll talk about next week, I have all the biological symptoms, some in an extreme way, of clinical depression. So I clearly have a serious chronic biological problem that affects my mood and my cognitive abilities and my behaviour. So I'm not questioning that, but I question now basically, it was a very negative experience for me. I took 8 or 9 different antidepressants over about 10 years and none of them did me any good. All I got were the side effects. And in fact, I never actually made a serious attempt at suicide until I was on antidepressants. And there have been many court cases, particularly about the dreaded Suroxat, which I took on 2 occasions. And in fact, I think it might have been while I was on that I first had seriously suicidal thoughts and started making plans. So having a diagnosis isn't always a positive thing. I know people who have reacted very well to medication and they've done very well and it's made them feel a lot better and they can cope with their lives much better. But in my case, I think the diagnosis was largely negative. It had a negative effect on my life. And anyway, okay, so Gordon Parker also talked about destigmatization. People are far more willing to talk publicly about their depression now, and celebrities doing this obviously gives the impression that it is far more prevalent than it really is. It's become a trendy issue to say that you have depression, and you see famous people talking about it. And while I think that's generally a good thing, especially people like Stephen Fry and Ruby Wax, who were very educated about the whole thing, obviously people like that, it gives the impression that, oh, everybody's got it. So that's another factor. And Gordon Parker also mentions disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which is a bit of a mouthful, a new category in DSM-5, which is a mood disorder that contains none of the symptoms of depression. In other words, it's just being in a bad mood, and that's now considered a medical condition, which it clearly isn't, like, in my opinion, internet addiction or shopping addiction. They're not medical conditions. And this all shows how extreme the modern trend towards overdiagnosis of mental health conditions has become. And it seems that we can put most, if not all, of the increase in rates of depression down to these small number of factors, rather than a genuine increase in true rates of clinical depression. Okay, so let's now move on to part two of the listener's question. Modern technological society has robbed many people of the sense of meaning and purpose that is so vital to sound mental health and a sense of general well-being and physical health. As I've said many times on the podcast and in my books, there has been no substantial human evolution for 40,000 years. Imagine presenting a caveman with cars, planes, and digital technology. Of course, it hasn't really been as sudden as that. Technology has been slowly evolving for tens of thousands of years, but the speed of change over the last 150 years has been nothing short of astronomical. We've gone from gaslighting being a newfangled innovation to the world of today in the blink of an evolutionary eye. People born in the last 20 years have become naturally accustomed to it because they have never known anything else, and older people like me have adapted to some elements and eschewed others. But when I use the word adapted here, I am only talking about a surface level utilitarian adaption, not a biological one. Yes, we can use laptops and mobile phones and everything else, and sometimes they even do what we ask them to. If we're lucky and Windows isn't having some kind of emotional issue and needs to shut down. But on a deeper level, we are still at odds with everything in the modern world. Nobody knows what effect this is having on us, because it is impossible to compare our lives with that of pre-industrial people based on anything but written anecdote and historical supposition. For example, it may well be true that many more people have disturbed sleep patterns than a few hundred years ago, but it is almost impossible to ascertain the precise causes of this, and we cannot send a modern human back to the Middle Ages and see whether or not their sleep improves. But we can state with certainty both that we have not adapted to the modern world, and that this failure is having some deleterious effects on our physical and mental health. And I am by no means the only person worried about these themes. Discussion is widespread. On a recent podcast, Joe Rogan asked the journalist and filmmaker Sebastian Younger whether we would ever adapt to the modern world, or would it just continue to make us depressed? So Joe Rogan himself has clearly concluded that there is a direct correlation, which I agree with. Younger replied that we haven't even adapted to the agricultural revolution of 10,000 years ago, which would explain why people are still unnecessarily stuffing their faces with food as if there's going to be a sudden scarcity of resources, because we haven't adapted. He went on to talk about the basic evolutionary method of positive traits surviving through those people having more children and passing on their genes. He also said that, largely speaking, unhappiness doesn't stop people reproducing, so there's no evolutionary imperative to breed that trait out of the species. So for us to biologically fully adapt to the 21st century would take at least 10,000 years. And that will only happen given the right kind of pressures on natural selection. So obviously, even if we did start adapting now, it doesn't bear thinking about if the human race is still around in 10,000 years, where technology will be then is just completely unimaginable. So we will never adapt. Younger also pointed out the high rates of depression amongst Peace Corps volunteers who return to the privilege of America from working in deprived countries. His conclusion based on this is that purpose and feeling useful is what makes people happy, not ease and comfort. This ties in with Sartre's famous comment about never feeling so free as under Nazi occupation. And this seems like a ridiculous thing to say, but what he meant by that statement was that when they were under Nazi occupation, suddenly the trivial things in life don't matter anymore. Because you were so restricted and you can be arrested and interned at any moment, from an existential point of view, it imbues anything, everything that you do, it imbues every single thing that you do, everything that you think, with a greater meaning and purpose. And many thinkers and psychologists and philosophers have come to this conclusion as well. And in fact, when the musician Brian Eno was on Desert Island Discs and he was asked what his luxury on the island would be, he initially said a giant man-eating spider for that very reason, because when you're in that kind of danger, it gives your life meaning and purpose and forces you to think about what's really important. And something else I think that Younger mentioned in the podcast was that during the Blitz in Britain during World War II, there were large preparations made for all the psychotherapy, such as it was then, that people were obviously going to need after this incredible trauma. But they found out that actually, during and after the Blitz, there were far lower rates of depression and mental illness than during peacetime. So again, that's the case of, you know, the old cliche of stiff upper lip and people pulling together. But also, if you're in that situation, then everything becomes meaningful and you don't really have the luxury of time to sit around being depressed. So we can safely say that modern technology has robbed many people of a sense of meaning and purpose through increased unemployment and a fragmenting of vital social groups and institutions. And this clearly has a negative effect on our mental health and sense of belonging. But what are the biological effects of 21st century technology? I've talked before about the blue light of digital screens. Just to briefly recap, if you are looking at a computer, a laptop screen, a mobile phone screen late at night, they all emit blue light. And if you're looking at your phone or your laptop at midnight, it fools your brain into thinking that it's daylight, so it decreases the hormones and neurotransmitters in the brain that make you go to sleep and increases the ones that keep you awake. And I can attest to this because in the past, when I have spent, say, 12 hours at a stretch at the computer working on music very intensely, I find that I would be awake for 48 hours afterwards because my brain was just buzzing and my whole circadian rhythms and biology had been thrown out by such an exposure to blue light. It's similar to the way people get over jet lag or seasonal affective disorder by having one of those blue lights. It's the same effect. All modern digital screens have that effect of disrupting sleep patterns. So it can be said that modern society and technology is changing us from a number of different directions. And given the way that evolution works, it seems that there is little we can do on a fundamental level to further adapt to this new world we have created around us. But there are things we can do, choices we can make to negate at least some of the harmful effects. Focus on getting enough good quality sleep. Minimise your exposure to digital technology where possible, especially in the evenings. Limit overindulgence in food and alcohol, and get plenty of exercise and direct exposure to sunlight. Just because something is technologically available doesn't mean that you have to use it. Maintain a balance in your life and you will reap the health benefits. So, in conclusion, I would say that rates of genuine clinical depression and mental illness have probably not increased significantly in recent times. However, there does seem to be a serious increase in people feeling much worse about themselves and their place in the world. I believe that the roots of this phenomena are societal, psychological, and existential, rather than clinical or medical. So, given this conclusion, I've written here the next episode, but as I've just said, the next episode is about the biology of depression and stress and anxiety. So episode 22 in 2 weeks' time will cover the social, psychological and philosophical reasons for people feeling disenfranchised and directionless. So as ever, if you have any questions or contributions on either of these themes for the next two episodes, please contact me via marcus.freestone@yahoo.com. That's Marcus with a C, marcus.freestone@yahoo.com, the Facebook page, or the elusive comment box on the website, if I can ever get the damn thing to work, which as of today, I still can't. So thanks for listening. Please share the podcast on all your social media. Consider making a small donation. Keep the questions coming in on any aspect of psychology, philosophy, or mental health, and particularly the biology of depression, stress and anxiety, or the social, psychological and philosophical reasons for people feeling disenfranchised and directionless. All questions welcome. So that's the next two episodes. This has been episode 20 and I have verily and forsooth been Marcus Freestone. See you next week.